Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In a tweet last week, President Trump predicted a very difficult meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Florida tomorrow. Trade and North Korea are big items on the table. On the campaign trail, Trump said Chinese trade practices were raping the USA. This week, he threatened unilateral action against North Korea if the U.S. can't get help from China. This hour on Point, China, the U.S., and the face-to-face in Florida. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Who's got the upper hand here? And what do you see coming in the meeting of Donald Trump and Xi Jinping? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Margaret Brennan, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. She'll be in Florida for the meeting tomorrow between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. Margaret, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I guess I have to ask first about the chemical attack reports coming out of Syria. Do you think these will figure into the conversation between the U.S. and China? The whole world has an interest in the world not sliding into chemical warfare. Is this the kind of issue that Donald Trump, that Xi Jinping might pick up?
It's something that'll be discussed in some way, since China does have veto power at the UN Security Council. So if there was any international action, China has to say whether it is standing with the United States or against it in terms of trying to punish Syria for what appears to be a violation of that deal brokered back in 2013 by John Kerry to have Syria hand over their declared chemical weapons. Obviously, all of them are not gone from the country. And what we are hearing today from groups like Doctors Without Borders is that the symptoms they see of those who suffered from the attack look like sarin gas. They could also be victims of chlorine gas attack. And the reason that matters, determining the gas, is it would be a clear violation, or perhaps if it was sarin, if it was chlorine gas, that puts the administration in a decision where they have to decide just how strictly they're going to enforce it, because possession of chlorine is not illegal, though weaponized chlorine gas is certainly so.
It was a red line putatively for the Obama administration, but then it wasn't. What about this administration? Is it a big deal to them in terms that might lead to action?
We don't know. The Trump administration appears to still be formulating their Syria policy. From the White House podium yesterday, you had a clear condemnation. You also had the president also say this was reprehensible, heinous actions. But then they quickly pivoted to politics, using almost campaign-like rhetoric to blame the previous administration for failing to enforce, as you said, that red line, that threat to attack Syria if they went through with chemical weapons attacks, which clearly they violated that warning, defied it, and continue to defy it now. And so President Trump, now in office, seems to be reversing his position. He previously was against any attacks and says, well, he's in a sticky spot because Barack Obama didn't solve the issue before he came to office. But that doesn't tell you what is next. And certainly there were many national security officials in Washington who really do fault the Obama administration for not taking stronger action to stop the slaughter in Syria, but who were really taken aback by that campaign-like rhetoric from the White House yesterday, saying there are certain things that do need to be above politics. And when you look at images of children foaming at the mouth, dying in the streets, suffering from war crimes, that is not a time to play petty politics.
Margaret, take us to the meeting tomorrow at Mar-a-Lago. Xi Jinping flies in from China, I guess, via Finland. Donald Trump will be there. They have had already an interesting relationship. They are two sort of tough guys, maybe out of different cloth, but both of them kind of tough guy leaders, at least in the way they like to present. What's top of the agenda for Xi Jinping and Donald Trump?
Well, if North Korea wasn't top of the agenda before, they certainly forced themselves into the top spot with this latest ballistic missile test that we saw. Clearly, Kim Jong-un, the mercurial leader of North Korea, does not fear China and does not, at this point, seem to fear the U.S. threats that they may face consequences for continuing to violate that ban against testing and continued development of their already existing nuclear program. So the question of what is China willing to do? Seemingly every president has said that the path to controlling Pyongyang goes through Beijing, but Beijing has limits to the amount of pressure they're willing to put on their client in North Korea. So we will likely hear some noise on this. We will likely hear Xi Jinping and Donald Trump say that this is unacceptable behavior. But as for what China is willing to do next, it's just not clear. And we do have some veiled, what would appear to be veiled threats from Donald Trump, the president, in the past few days, saying that if China doesn't help, the U.S. will solve this issue on its own. Not clear whether that means military strikes or exactly what that means. We did hear from Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in a what could be an ominous statement, but certainly an unusual one, saying yesterday that the United States has talked enough about North Korea and they're done talking.
But of course, the formula has always been that military action was nearly impossible because North Korea has so much artillery aimed at Seoul, the very large heart of, capital of South Korea, not far from the demilitarized zone there. Is there anything to suggest that some kind of military option, real option that wouldn't involve the destruction of South Korea's capital has emerged here?
No, you're exactly right. And of course, South Korea is a U.S. military ally that we would be bound to defend if that happened. That would spark a war. And so that is one of the fundamental challenges here. But what the U.S. has done, what the past administration has done and the current one appears to be continuing to pursue is the use of cyber attacks to, in some ways, get these missiles to fizzle out or to not be able to launch as they continue to try to develop this program. The problem with that, from what I'm told by U.S. officials, is they just don't know their success rate. They don't know if it's incompetence or they don't know on the part of the North Koreans in having these tests fail or if they're actually being successful on the U.S. side in having these attempts to really constrain their program through cyber attacks. The other issue with China is they're giving that economic lifeline to North Korea. But again, there are limits to what Beijing's willing to do because they don't want an unstable state on their border, and they don't want the collapse of that state. As the former Secretary of State John Kerry used to say, you know, Beijing has a lot of leverage in North Korea, but they don't have a lot of influence. They have levers of power they could use. They're not choosing to use them, or Kim Jong-un simply does not care.
What about U.S. leverage here? I want to go back for just a second. On the campaign trail, candidate Donald Trump was very vivid in linking North Korea and trade. And this was the famous bit in, this is Fort Wayne, Indiana, last May, almost a year ago, where then candidate Trump said the United States needed to tie together the China's policy on North Korea and American thinking about Chinese trade policy, where he said China was raping the United States. Here he was.
When China doesn't want to fix the problem in North Korea, we say, sorry, folks, you got to fix the problem. Because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
Margaret Brennan, that language just about as hot as you can get. And now comes a Chinese leader who's you know, no joker himself. I mean, Xi Jinping is seen as quite the strong man in China. Could Donald Trump roll out some kind of trade threat? Is there U.S. leverage to move China on North Korea on trade at all?
Absolutely. There's leverage on both sides. We're each other's own best customers on many fronts. And so there's really only so far you can go with those threats without hurting U.S. interests as well. And so Xi Jinping walks into this meeting with that level of confidence, knowing that a trade war is not likely to be something that President Trump is willing to carry out, particularly given the business leaders within his own cabinet right now who know full well what the economic and business impact would. They are globalists themselves, though the rhetoric may not match that. They know how markets work. And so they're going to try to avoid a trade war, but will certainly try to use the levers of power there, whether it's through World Trade Organization or other venues. But we will likely hear at the conclusion of this summit at Mar-a-Lago some promises that we will continue to work together on this front. I don't know if they're going to be talking much publicly about cyber. That was an issue that the Obama administration at least got some headway on in laying the groundwork for sketching out a future policy there. We do know U.S. officials say climate change and that policy that Xi Jinping and President Obama brokered, one of the few things they really could say they agreed on, that's not going to be on the table here. So the points of mutual interest in this summit tomorrow and on Friday seem to be on controlling, trying to get North Korea under control and really focusing in on trade there. And Xi Jinping, he's got a big meeting coming up in his own country in terms of Communist Party leadership. The optics of this are going to be really important for him. You will not see him on that golf course as a Chinese leader who has cut back sharply and really cracked down on what they've said is, you know, embezzlement and abuse of power by Chinese officials. He's not allowed to really look like he's enjoying himself too much in Mar-a-Lago this weekend. And most of what he says is going to be highly scripted, highly choreographed. And that's what's going to be fascinating, because whatever you believe of President Donald Trump, I don't think you can say he's heavily scripted or choreographed. So seeing this kind of diplomatic summit is going to be fascinating to watch.
Can they both come out looking like winners from this meeting, Margaret? Is that possible?
Well, that win-win phrase is actually something that the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, keeps using, something the Chinese have used in the past as well. They can come out both looking like winners if they make these, you know, with platitudes saying we will, you know, what North Korea is doing is unacceptable and we'll work together. They can continue to say we will try to have more fair trade policies. But the stakes are pretty high for both because this is, in many ways, the most important long-term strategic foreign policy issue for the United States to get right, and definitely for the Chinese as well. And there are a lot of potential missteps. And so we are told Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will in many ways be taking the lead in this conversation and trying to keep them choreographed.
Of course, Rex Tillerson, new to this realm. He's been there for Exxon, not long still in his position as Secretary of State. And Donald Trump, of course, new to the White House. Margaret Brennan, White House and Senior Affairs Correspondent for CBS News, will be there tomorrow in Florida covering all this with us today. Margaret, thank you very much for your time and insights.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're talking this hour about China and the United States as Chinese leader President Xi Jinping heads to Florida and Mar-a-Lago to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump. Their first face-to-face meeting. They've spoken on the telephone, but this is the first time face-to-face, and it comes not long after yet the latest ballistic missile test by North Korea, where nuclear arsenal is apparently growing and substantial, trade tensions, and a lot more to talk about here. You can join us this hour. What's the right thing for the U.S. to do on trade with China? And can the president, the U.S. president, get Beijing to help rein in North Korea's nukes? How, and if not, do you see the U.S. taking on North Korea somehow alone? Is that even possible? Last week, President Trump signed a couple of new executive orders related to trade at the White House. He used that opportunity to look ahead to his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
I've spoken to him numerous times on the phone. We look very much forward to it. But it's been very bad what's been happening to our country in terms of our companies and in terms of our jobs. So we're going to start turning it around. We're going to turn it around fast. It's not going to take a long time. It's going to go fast.
Yeah, well, maybe. Last week he said the meeting's going to be very difficult. This week, at a town hall meeting with 50 business leaders at the White House yesterday, little change in tone.
We're going to have a great meeting. I'm sure we're going to have a fantastic meeting, and we're going to talk about a lot of things, including, of course, North Korea, a problem, and that's really a humanity problem. So we're going to be talking about that also.
A humanity problem. Not quite sure what that is, but it's a big problem. That is for sure. To look at this meeting right now, joining us from New York is Susan Shirk, chair of the 21st Century China Center at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Susan Shirk, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks very much, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And Scott Kennedy joins us from Washington, director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Scott Kennedy, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Susan Shirk, how would you describe the power relationship or ratio between these two big powers as they sit down in Florida? Who's got the upper hand now, or does anyone?
Well, it's a lot more equal than it had been a few years ago, because China has tremendous economic leverage over the United States and other countries, and they have shown themselves willing to use that market power of their huge market to get their way politically and diplomatically with other countries. We saw it with Norway, Norwegian salmon, and the Nobel Prize that was given to a democracy activist from China. We saw it with the Philippines. We've seen it with Taiwan. And now we see it with South Korea, a lot of pressure on South Korea through a kind of boycott and consumer boycott of Korean products and culture.
Because of the new missile defense system.
Because of the missile defense system.
Considering putting in there the U.S. system.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I don't see China using that against the United States unless it's provoked by some draconian action on the part of the Trump administration. But if the Trump administration were to use, you know, across-the-board tariffs on Chinese imports, for example, there's no doubt but that China would retaliate. So, you know, when I hear President Trump talk, it sounds like, you know, I don't know, the 1980s or 90s, when the United States could just kind of dictate to other countries and they'd fall into line. But certainly with China, that's no longer the case.
What, Scott Kennedy, what does Xi Jinping need to bring home? Well, think about Donald Trump and the promises, implicit, explicit, that he's made to American supporters. But what about Xi Jinping and what he needs to project back to China from Mar-a-Lago, what he needs to bring home?
That's a terrific question, and they both have very different goals for this meeting. I think for Xi Jinping, the meeting itself is the message, simply being able to go to Mar-a-Lago and have this face-to-face gives him brownie points at home. In addition,
really,
secondly,
couldn't he come home looking like hell if he seems to get chewed out? But I mean, this is a guy with a big kind of strongman image in his own country, China. He's coming to Donald Trump, who Chinese like to do diplomacy by script. Donald Trump goes off script all the time. Aren't there risks on exactly that point in the meeting for Xi Jinping?
There are. I think he's got two other goals in addition, mm-hmm. just to getting the meeting itself, which means a lot. The second is to not be embarrassed by President Trump and to hold his own if Trump decides to unload on him and he can unload back. But I think his most important policy goal is to try and find a floor for the relationship, because it looks like, based on the campaign rhetoric and things that President Trump has said since, that there could be a major conflict over the Korean Peninsula, over trade, and what Xi Jinping is trying to do is put a floor on the bottom of the relationship to avoid those outcomes. But he comes in extremely confident politically. He is the core leader now, recognized by everybody else. He should run the table later this year at the 19th Party Congress, which selects China's next leadership for the following 5 years. So he's coming in extremely confident.
Confident, and yet face is a big deal, Susan Shirk. If Donald Trump goes off script or goes after him, that in China, this is enormous.
Well, certainly it is. And although, Scott's a great observer and analyst of Chinese domestic politics, I do disagree a bit about how secure Xi Jinping feels. You know, he's in these final months before the midterm in his reign, and he has alienated a lot of other senior leaders by the way he's carried out this anti-corruption campaign, which is at least in part a purge of potential rivals. The economy is slowing down, and there are a lot of risks in the economy. So I think all Chinese leaders, including Xi Jinping, really always feel nervous about their standing domestically. So there are risks for him, but he does have a lot of leverage, as I said earlier. And I think He believes that he may have gotten some informal agreements through Jared Kushner, his channel into the Trump administration on exactly how this summit will be handled. So that may give him a little bit more security.
The Chinese leader laying down some markers of his own. He went to Davos as Donald Trump and his crew down or badmouthed globalism all the time. He went to sort of the heart of the globalist elite in January. Praised open trade, warned against protectionism, kind of shot across the bow, it sounded like, of the U.S. Here he was.
Pursuing protectionism is just like locking oneself in a dark room, while wind and rain may be kept outside, so are light and air. No one will emerge as a winner in a trade war.
Xi Jinping in Davos, Switzerland. Scott Kennedy, you've got this funny situation now where China, which in its rise to economic strength has been pretty dirty and pretty polluting, so of course so was the U.S. over a long period before it cleaned up, now emerging as a clean energy champion as Donald Trump has retreated on that front just very recently. And also as a kind of champion of free and open trade, though they've had more restrictive trade policies than the United States for a long time. So look at trade, Scott. Donald Trump has suggested that he wants a whole new kind of relationship with China. Is it out there to be had? What kind of changes might he seek? What might he get?
Sure. I first mentioned Xi Jinping's statement in Davos and others about the importance of defending globalization and free trade are terrific rhetoric, but they mask massive industrial policy and a lot of protectionism. So he can do that because of Trump's positions.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, that said, it's going to take a lot to get more than token concessions from China. Xi Jinping is certainly coming with a list of things to offer in terms of more Chinese investment in the United States, opening up a few more sectors to investment, buying some more American goods. But really what the Trump administration wants, and actually what many administrations before them have sought but never been able to fully achieve, is a much more liberalized Chinese economy where there's fairer treatment of American businesses, investors, and the products that they're trying to sell. It's going to be very difficult for him to do it because even though he still has these big bilateral sticks that he could use, Section 301, WTO cases, anti-dumping cases, he gave away a big one when he walked away from TPP. That's not all his fault. The Obama administration could have done a much better job in pushing TPP through, but nevertheless, that regional and international pressure would have been tremendous. It would have been the leverage that Susan and others suggested that we could have had to have made the choice much harder on Xi Jinping and China.
It was designed to make the U.S. a continuing power at China's expense in Asia, and now that's right off the table. What about the trade front, Susan? Yes, please.
I was going to say that actually the task force report that our 21st Century China Center and the Asia Society, Orville Schell, rolled out about a month ago recommending a new strategy toward China for the next administration, of course, never expecting it would be a Trump administration. We actually had hoped that we could develop a collaborative game plan with Chinese government officials to step by step move China into TPP. And the Chinese government actually never said that it would never join TPP. And there are many reform-minded economists and officials in China that were hoping that China could eventually join TPP, and that would create the pressure to sustain the continued market reform and opening that Deng Xiaoping launched, four decades
ago. But now you've got the U.S. out and China forming its own trade bloc in Asia.
Yeah. And, when I heard Xi Jinping at Davos, I felt some satisfaction, actually, and some hope that he feels that his prestige and China's prestige is enhanced by building a reputation as a responsible power protecting the open global trade. Now this creates some pressure on him to try to actually move China's own policies in that direction, because if he says these pretty words, but the reality inside China, as Scott said, is highly protectionist and mercantilist, then, it's just not going to be a credible stance.
Scott Kennedy, how about it? Is it possible that he may like to put on that mantle, or certainly he's talking against protectionism here. China still exports a lot to the U.S., runs at, what, almost $350 billion surplus with the U.S., the U.S. deficit there. But maybe underneath all that, the real push for free trade without the U.S. strong out front on it is just diminishing, Scott.
I do think it's going to be tough. Xi Jinping, his advisors, many experts in China, as Susan mentioned, know that China's economy, although it's grown tremendously over the last several decades and is a world-class performer, is facing strong headwinds. If the efficiency of the economy has just tanked, even though they've continued to maintain relatively good growth. And they know that they need to liberalize, but that requires them to take on special interests, state-owned enterprises, put their financial system at risk. And Xi Jinping has shown that he just is very unwilling to give up this habit of control. It's reflected in the economy and politics and foreign policy. And so really, if you don't use not only a whole-of-government approach to respond to Xi Jinping and put pressure, but alliances, creating a broader community as we did when we brought China into WTO 15 years ago, it's going to be really, really difficult. So really, if the big sticks pulling China into a black alley, you know, don't work, then it makes it seem like the only thing that's going to really change things there is a financial crisis, which might give them religion to realize that they really need to change.
Let's go to our listeners, Dean in Austin, Texas. Dean, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I'd just like to ask your panel a question. Could this be an opportunity or maybe a potential for Xi Jinping to take the world stage as possibly the leader of the free world? I mean, that sounds crazy, but, you know, with our president and all the turmoil his administration's been in, the credibility in the toilet since day one, it's got to be in the sewer at this point. It's gone negative since then. At home and on the world stage, I think. I mean, he's 35%.
But leader of the free world, Dean? I mean, he's head of the Communist Party in China. China's got all kinds of restrictions on.
I understand, but somebody's got to fill this vacuum, though, that's left over. This attack on liberal democracy, the attack on freedom of press that you see at home, we've never seen here in America. I'd like to know what your panel thought about that, the potential at Mar-a-Lago this weekend for him to upstage Trump in a way, just on that basis.
Yeah. Susan Shirk, Dean, thanks for your call. Susan, it's hard to picture the Chinese leader as leader of the free world. My head is spinning here. On the other hand, leader, as global leader, what about Dean's question? Who cast the longer shadow here?
Well, it really will be a delicate performance for Xi Jinping, especially in the public part of the meeting, to appear to be strong, respectful, friendly, while at the same time, you know, I can imagine that domestically, Xi Jinping tries to explain to Xi Jinping kind of economics 101 why the bilateral trade deficit in and of itself really doesn't matter. Why the countries are so interdependent, why an open global trading rules are actually beneficial to the United States as well as China. So, you know, it'll be hard to know exactly how he can balance this. Of course, he can't be leader of the free world. I mean, China's made a U-turn not just in its economic policies, but also in its policies toward civil society, toward the media, toward religion. And China is more authoritarian and more repressive than it's ever been before.
So
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China and the U.S. as Chinese leader Xi Jinping heads to Mar-a-Lago in Florida to meet with Donald Trump tomorrow, looking at what's on the agenda and who's got the power now. Susan Shirk is with us from the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. Scott Kennedy is here from the Center for Strategic and International Studies and their project on Chinese business and political economy. You can join us as well. What do you see coming in this meeting, and how do you see the power relationship now between the U.S. and China, whether it's on trade or North Korea, or China in the South China Sea, Taiwan, Hong Kong's autonomy, you name it. Is it weird that they're meeting at Mar-a-Lago, or that's just the way it is? Let's go to Ellen in Somerville, South Carolina. Ellen, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I'm sad to say that I believe that our president is an embarrassment to our country, and I think he has no foreign policy. He makes up things every moment, and that he will treat foreign leaders that we need to be a little bit difficult with the same way that he treated Mr. Sisi. And I would like to see what your panel thinks about that.
Mm-hmm. Susan, you're uh-huh-ing meaning what?
Meaning, I think there is a risk that his advisors, some of his advisors, have said it's very important to act respectful, you know, don't be too in his face publicly, especially. And so Trump goes this other direction of being overly respectful and getting sucked in to taking an overly deferential position, including maybe committing to some principles in our relationship, which would, without really understanding
such
what they're all
like
about.
What? Like?
Well, you know, this happened a bit with Mr. Tillerson when he visited Beijing, in which he used the exact language that the Chinese wanted to use for this new type of great power relationship. The original version of the Chinese term, new type of great power relationship, was not just to try to avoid the Thucydides trap of a conflict between a rising power and the incumbent power.
This is what Graham Allison writes about. So
right.
War is always in the wings or a possibility when you have a sitting power and a rising power meeting.
Right. And it is a dangerous point, and history shows that it is. And certainly from the U.S. perspective, we agree with that. But the Chinese threw into the mix this notion of us respecting their core interests. And the top one is the continued rule of the Communist Party and Chinese sovereignty, including these maritime claims in the South China Sea. So there's a possibility of getting suckered into that. Of course, when Mr. Tillerson said it, he didn't mention the core interest. That's the thing that President Trump has to avoid at all costs. He should not defer to China's core interests because China defines those interests in a way that is antithetical to the interests of other Asian countries and to the United States.
I mean, I wonder
not all of them, but the South China Sea one, not the ones related to Tibet or Xinjiang and those sovereignty issues.
Right. I mean, he talks this game about America First. He was doing it again yesterday. This was the president of the United States at the North America Building Trades Unions National Legislative Conference, saying, I don't want to be president of the world. And Scott, I want to ask you how this comes across. Here was President Trump yesterday.
I'm not, and I don't want to be, the president of the world. I'm the president of the United States. And from now on, it's going to be America first.
Scott, how does that work within this relationship? Part of the U.S. strength had been, as our caller from Austin, Texas was saying, being seen as leader of the free world, at least. How does the America, but America first suggests a kind of confrontational attitude on interests. So how's it work through, Scott?
I think it's ironic that in some ways the Chinese will recognize this because they've been practicing a China first foreign policy right. for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And so what we are seeing is in some ways, although President Trump and Xi Jinping are very different and the two countries' political systems are very different, more nationalistic foreign policies on both sides. Trump has gone in a way very different from the history of both the Republican and Democratic Party since World War II. Those both parties and each of our presidents believed that the U.S. was not being the president of the world, but was setting up a system that was to the American advantage, the international liberal system, and that the U.S., in order to protect its place in the world, needed to protect that order and provide public goods. President Trump sees those public goods as a cost for the United States rather than a benefit for the United States. And I think actually Xi Jinping and the Chinese feel the same way. Your previous caller asked about maybe it's time for the Chinese to provide leadership, and she used the word liberal. I'd say probably more illiberal leadership. But China is not going to be able to achieve that because the Chinese aren't willing to provide public goods that cost them anything. And so we're looking more at a vacuum of global leadership rather than the Chinese coming in and taking over.
But if it's, Susan, if it's about interests more strictly rather than about interests and values, which had been the U.S. kind of stance for decades, whose interest does that play to ultimately?
Well, I think it's tragic. I mean, our president now is throwing away American leadership, which is very much in our national interests. You know, we help build all these global institutions, the G20, the World Trade Organization, the United Nations organizations, all the arms control agreements, and that was very reassuring to other countries in the world because it was in our interests. We had the leadership. But on the other hand, we were also bound by the global system so mm-hmm. that we weren't just pursuing our narrowly defined selfish interests because you're never going to get other countries to want to cooperate with you, to join you in common efforts if they think your goals are so, so narrow, just your national self-interest. And by trashing those agreements and institutions, by saying that our interests are so narrowly defined, Trump is really isolating the United States from the rest of the world.
And what about the values front?
It's tragic. The values front is another dimension where U.S. prestige and U.S. influence definitely came from, you know, Joe Nye's Our Soft Power. The values that American democracy and free enterprise represent, and they were they've been respected all around the world. They've been successful. They've led to a very dynamic economy. Our open immigration system was, again, a contrast with many other countries and a great economic advantage to us and a social advantage to our melting pot. All of these things that have together defined American influence in the world, our president is basically unraveling and isolating us.
But he did that on the campaign stage, very explicitly, he said, these are costing us. They're not working for us. We've got to stop being encumbered by them. We've got to be more fiercely just centered on our interests. And many Americans voted for that, Susan.
Well, that's certainly true. They did. And, you know, obviously, we were not doing a very good job of meeting the needs of a whole group of people in our population. But, and I think that a policy toward China, as our task force report recommends, should be based on our national interests. But our national interests are broader than the way President Trump is defining them.
Let me go to Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, one of our most famous quotes, one of our most famous poets in American history, if you show me what you are, then I'll believe you. And the fact that so many people are surprised that Donald Trump is what he is, even though he's been showing us for over 30 years in public life what he is astonishing.
How does it bear out in this meeting, Carl?
Well, he has this affinity towards dictators, and he have an affinity towards bluster. And I believe that campaigning is different from governing. And I'm afraid of what he's going to do and what he's going to say when faced with that reality, that he has to govern instead of going out and campaigning in front of his rabid followers.
So watch out. Carl, it's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your call very much. Let me get one more, and we'll pick it up right here. Michael in – oh, here's a call from Ukraine, from Kharkiv, Ukraine. Michael, you're on the air. Hello, Michael. Are you there, my friend?
You talking to me, Tom?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm here. Great. It's nice to talk to you again. You know, the thing I'm worried about is that, confronted with Trump's abject ignorance about everything, about history, economy, world affairs, that Xi is going to just realize what a fool he is and then move to test them in the South China Sea or something, and in some real provocative action. Now, you know, with that, Obama was pretty weak too, but the UN ruled against China, and they seem to be about to accept that decision, and then Duterte, as I call him, you know, rolled over.
Duterte, the leader of the Philippines.
I love the Chinese. Has pretty much made some kind of deal with them where he doesn't really care that they're 40 or 50 miles offshore Philippine waters. And he's armored these islands with anti-aircraft, I believe, with some of the best missiles. And the next step really is just to declare an air defense zone where he says, that no overflight should happen and all these commercial airlines will have to avoid it. Or even Putin doing the same thing. You know, you see the poison gas in Syria, and for once America's standing up for human rights and objecting and screaming about this, and yet then Trump says, oh, but, you know, it's the fault of Obama. It's like, well, you're president now. It's like, it's your job. It's not Obama's job, you know? It's like,
well, Michael, we've got it. The idea of a potential test coming here, if Xi Jinping sees an opportunity there. We're looking at the meeting of the Chinese leader and the president in Mar-a-Lago tomorrow. A couple of worried calls there, Scott, yes, about, where Donald Trump might draw lines here and how he might be sized up by Xi Jinping. What do you say?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So let's just have a little historical context, I think, would be helpful to address some of the concerns and frustrations, which are totally understandable. I think it's important to understand that the historic American foreign policy towards China, our approach was to try and integrate China into a rules-based order, deter them on Taiwan and some other places, but for the most part, try and integrate them. And I think that worked largely for the first 30 years. You had Chinese leaders that were interested in integrating and adapting. I think Xi Jinping is a very different kind of leader, and China is also much stronger. He isn't interested in having China integrate into the world. He wants to make the world safe for China in its current form. And so it's been difficult for the U.S. to find its bearings to figure out how to adjust its policy. We need a Goldilocks policy. Obviously, it can't just be simply talking everything through and encouragement or hitting China back with sticks. You have to find that Goldilocks middle ground. Trump brought the idea of change into the campaign, said he's going to do things very differently. And I think for some people who've worked on China and see the challenges we have with them, being a little bit tougher on China, turning up the dial, is something welcome. The question is, is he the right agent to do it? He comes in with very little experience. He has very little staff yet. And, you know, this meeting, which is occurring, you know, tomorrow, is occurring amazingly early in his administration. Very few presidents have ever met a Chinese leader this early. So our expectations need to go beyond what's going to happen tomorrow to look at, will it be possible for the Trump administration to get a full team in place, put out some markers, and then gradually work on these. None of this is going to be solved in a few months, let alone a few hours in Mar-a-Lago.
Susan, what the tougher on China posture that was the president's even before he was elected on the campaign trail, how do you see its effect so far?
Well, the way he's done it has been very counterproductive because especially the first bomb he threw about our one China policy, which suggested that we might use our robust informal relationship with Taiwan as a bargaining chip to get a better deal from China in other issue areas. In the end, Xi Jinping refused to talk to him until he would back down from that and reaffirm our one China policy. And so he was forced to back down. So this set a very bad precedent because it looked like he was all bluster, but in the end, he would fold. And of course, domestically, we also see on some issues where there's been a lot of bluster, but the president wasn't able to deliver and had to back down. So, you know, Xi Jinping is, I think, feels less intimidated by Donald Trump than he might have a few months ago. On the other hand, I just want to agree with what Scott said about the need to push back more. You know, China hands really have been saying that our approach that we have pursued of talk and engagement has not been as effective as it once had been, and that we do need to push back more. But it's going to take real statesmanship to do that effectively, and that's the big question for this meeting.
That's the balance beam that both leaders will be on tomorrow. Susan Shirk at the UC San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy, thanks very much for being with us today, Susan.
My pleasure.
And Scott Kennedy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Happy to do so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.